Hi, this is Kurt Anderson. Over the years on Studio 360, I've gotten to talk with dozens of incredible filmmakers, all kinds of actors and directors. Here are a few of my favorite conversations, some of which are a few years old. Hope you enjoy them, and thanks for listening. This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. The first time I, and probably you, saw Matthew McConaughey was 20 years ago in Dazed and Confused, Richard Linklater's coming-of-age comedy about 1970s teenagers. McConaughey perfectly played David Wooderson, a Texas dude in his 20s who still hangs out with high schoolers for the fringe benefits.
That's what I love about these high school girls, man. I get older, they stay the same age.
Two decades later, McConaughey has given maybe the best performance of his career as sort of a grislier, older, not really very grown-up version of David Wooderson. In Dallas Buyers Club, the actor lost about a quarter of his body weight to turn into Ron Woodruff, a macho Texas hellraiser who gets diagnosed with AIDS in the 1980s.
Why are we here?
Just for this wine, dine, have a good time, enjoy ourselves.
Right.
It's as simple as that, I promise you, Doc. Come on, try it with me. Breathe. Relax. Smell the steak. If you need more inspiration, just look at the handsome man sitting across the table from you, paying for your dinner.
And Matthew McConaughey, welcome to Studio 360.
Good to be here.
When you were preparing to play Ron Woodruff in Dallas Buyers Club, did you ever make the connection that he was conceivably the grown-up version of Dave Wooderson in Dazed and Confused?
No, and I don't think there is one, but I'm curious because someone else said that.
Really?
Yeah. Now, where'd you get that from?
These guys in Texas who, you know, he could have gone that way.
No, I don't think so. As Wooderson says, he's got it figured out.
Yeah.
I mean, I think Wooderson's back there right now, probably married, got three daughters, and I think he's hosting a late midnight radio station playing his greatest hits.
So this character, Ron Woodruff, plays it closer to the edge in more dangerous ways before he ever gets AIDS.
Yeah, well, Ron Woodruff was – talk about living on the edge, and if you're not, you're taking up too much room. This guy was clawing at the edges. And, I mean, not like he was the only one living a wild, wonderful lifestyle, as he considered it back then, I'm sure. But he was also – a guy looking for a line in life, looking for a little structure and what to do. He was unsuccessful somewhat at his job. He was a guy who couldn't finish anything.
He was an electrician on the oil fields as well as riding bulls in the rodeo.
Yeah. And at that time, you know, I got a hold of his diary from his family and I saw who the guy was before he had HIV. And here's a guy who wanted out of there. He wanted to – and he didn't – ironically, he didn't really find direction in his life until he got HIV, and that gave him something to fight for 24/7.
I want to play a clip from the film in which his doctor, your doctor, played by Jennifer Garner, confronts the character about stealing her other AIDS patients, essentially.
Roger Thompson. This is my patient. You treating these people?
Oh, they're treating themselves.
With what?
Vitamins, peptide T, DDC, anything but that poison you're hawking. So you ever wear any color? Seems like every time I see you, all I see is white. You got white coat, white shoes, white.
Tell Rayon I was looking for him, and I am telling my patients to stay away from here.
Why?
Excuse me.
So you want to go grab steak sometime? I know it's red.
So we're dealing with HIV, and we have an AIDS drama. Well, okay, it's coming from a heterosexual's point of view. That's original. But this guy is a son of a bitch. And after he gets it, he's not the same son of a bitch he is when you meet him. He wouldn't have got the things done that he got done unless he was that candidate.
This kind of skeevy outlaw guy.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
He was a little Scarface.
Yeah.
Honestly.
Yeah.
I mean, he was smuggling in vitamins and drugs, and he was selling them on the black market. And even though it was Dallas Buyers Clubs, and there was a club in New York, there's a club in San Francisco, there's a club in Florida, they were cutthroat. They were like little mafias. They were not working together.
Even though they were trying to get these unavailable drugs to HIV AIDS
to live longer and live healthier lives, they were cutthroat.
It seems that you must have filmed Dallas Buyers Club around the time you filmed your brief role in Wolf of Wall Street. you play this coked-out guru broker who shows Leonardo DiCaprio's character the ropes at the beginning of the film. I want to play a little bit of you teaching him your tribal Wall Street trader chant.
Come on.
And they're doing that in a fancy restaurant in Wall Street. Now, that chant sounds – or the not the, the chant, but the hitting the chest is sort of like something my wife does every morning. Is it something – was it scripted or is it something
– No, it wasn't scripted. And it is actually something I do most mornings. What's your wife do?
She does a whole Qigong, okay. Tai Chi practice.
So it's voice. It's relaxation. Yeah. That's exactly what I was doing it for. I do it before I'll go act to get my voice right. Down low, to get it out of my throat, to relax myself, to actually somewhat look foolish and make people go, what the hell is he doing? Which is empowering if you're stepping into a production for one day's work and they're all working together already for months. So I do it myself, and I was doing it before each take, and then we'd say, okay, now we're ready for the take, and I'd stop and start the scene. Well, we had done the scene 5 takes and we had it.
Without that thing.
Without that. Martin was happy. I was happy. Leonardo was happy. So he goes, okay, man, I think we can move on. And Leonardo raised his hand. I remember a finger in there. And he goes, hang on a second, Martin. He goes, hey, McConaughey, what's that thing you're doing? And I told him, it's for my voice to relax. And he goes, what if you put that in the scene? And I said, okay. And so we started the next take and I started off the scene, did it, and then got into the scene. And at the end of the scene, it was like, okay, well, let's bookend it because you just laid out the lay of the land. Let's bookend this prophecy you just laid out in a common denominator baseline, like the rhythm I started. Now you get it. Now do it with me. Now you got it. There we go. Now you'll be on your way.
I've never heard a better example of improvisation that works and is important. It's not just, oh, that's funny. It is funny.
Yeah.
But it really kind of makes that character in the very few minutes he's on screen.
The last couple of takes, I don't think Marty and I even really spoke English. It was all sounds and movements and the fairy dust stuff. And so we got into the cosmos.
Yeah. In so many articles and interviews you've given over the last few years, you've mentioned this second coming, this, as my daughter some time ago informed me, the reconnaissance. After a year off from working, you started taking on these more challenging roles, playing anti-heroes. And now we have this kind of astounding run of great performances in these distinct movies. Bernie, Killer Joe, Magic Mike, Mud, Dallas Buyers Club, Wolf of Wall Street, in a very short period of time. Were these kinds of roles and scripts just not showing up in your box? Or did you change your criteria for what you thought you should do? Or what happened?
It was both. I mean, they were not. I got the call from Steve Soderbergh from Magic Mike. I got the call from William Friedkin about Killer Joe. Mud was something. Mud was around. Mud, written by Jeff Nichols. He wrote that with me in mind 12 years before we made it. So that was there. But, you know, without Mud, I don't know if Scorsese calls, because that's the film that he saw that the producer of Mud, Lisa Falcone, showed him that made him go, this McConaughey is interesting with us. So one, they weren't coming. Number two, I was not obviously I was not a good idea for these directors at maybe 2 years prior. So what I did was I took some time off, talked with my wife, my agent, and said, look, I'm going to recalibrate my relationship here with what's going on in my career. And I like what I've been doing, but you know what I've been doing, I feel like when I'm seeing another romantic comedy or action comedy or action, I feel like I can do that next week. And I'm not shaking in my boots enough. It's not moving my floor. And I want to do something that scares the hell out of me and get in some things that I really feel like I can give more of myself to. And so that meant taking some time off and going into the shadows. Now, what happened in that 2 years? There we go in the funny way life works, and somehow the target drew the arrow because all of a sudden I became a good idea.
I mean, I've never seen such a radical and instantaneous right. transformation of – a guy who is perceived as one thing mm-hmm. into a guy who is perceived at the top of his game as another thing.
Right. I packed my back-to-back of last year, the Magic Mike, Killer Joe, Paperboy, and Mud. I wanted to do like two of them And then I didn't feel like I had time to do the other two. But I was like, I need a little more break. And it was my wife who said, hey, grab your pair, man. If you want to do all four, we'll make it happen. And let's get it on.
Magic Mike, which you mentioned, which Steven Soderbergh directed, it was an independent film, but it was a bigger, showier thing from the get-go. It's a kind of perfect left turn from what you were familiar with.
Well, it was not a left turn. It was more of what I did in that for a lot of people is I popped the proverbial balloon. I kind of took some of what was my image of, hey, man, you're in shape, shirtless on the beach every day and going running. And I said, well, let's go to the Smithsonian with this.
Yes. Let's play a clip from that film. This is, in fact, you playing this guy, Dallas, who's a veteran stripper, and he's teaching an up-and-comer some moves at his club.
Yeah.
You're not just stripping. Are you all fulfilling every woman's wildest fantasies? You are the husband that they never had. You are that dreamboat guy that never came along. You are the one-night stand, that free fling of a... that they get to have tonight with you on stage and still go home to their hubby and not get in trouble because you, baby, you made it legal. You are the liberation. Own it.
That was Matthew McConaughey in Magic Mike and here in front of me silently reciting the lines as his character said them.
I remember that. That was my first day of shooting. That was the one that got Dallas off the ground and we... The wardrobe was so much fun in that. They had all these sweats and Rydells and Champion sort of sweats that people would wear at the gym. And I was like, no, this is Richard Simmons meets Baryshnikov. Yeah.
2014, you're going to be in this big Christopher Nolan movie, Interstellar, which a certain part of the world couldn't be more excited about. But you're also in this HBO show called True Detective with your old pal, whom you've worked with before, Woody Harrelson. Your character is this troubled kind of Nietzschean figure in Louisiana. He's a homicide detective. You play him when he's both 30-ish, I guess, and then in his mid-40s, seemingly a different man. Was that part of, in that case, the acting challenge that said, that's interesting?
Well, the 17-year span that you're talking about was part of the interest here. I mean, number one, just basically, I read the first two episodes. That's what was submitted to me. And they wanted me to look at the role of Hart. And while I liked it and said, I understand why they're coming to me for this role, the guy who I can't wait to hear what comes out of his mouth every time I turn the page is this guy, Rustin Cole. And I've never done that, but I know who this guy is. And so I read the first two episodes and said, look, I like the role of Cole. If you guys are interested in me for Cole, I'm in.
I contemplate the moment in the garden, the idea of allowing your own crucifixion.
But you're not a Christian, so what do you believe?
Look, I'd consider myself a realist, all right? But in philosophical terms, I'm what's called a pessimist.
Okay, what's that mean?
It means I'm bad at parties.
Let me tell you, you ain't great outside of parties either.
You know, when you first meet Cole, he's a guy, it's all boiling underneath. He's trying to hold it together. And here's a guy who has to have a case to figure out to survive. If he doesn't, he goes off the rails. And he's holding – this. Having a case is what's holding him together. Now, what you see 17 years later is a guy who submitted and said, yeah. Hey, man, all the rough edges are what they
yes.
are. All right? This – I am what I am in this life. That's it.
Yeah.
You know, so there's no – Rustin Cole is a man who does not con himself, as we all con ourselves. This is a man with a constitution and a self-counsel that is hard to watch. And, boy, you wouldn't wish it on anybody.
You seem like such a mentally healthy person, which is interesting given that the McConaissance and this run of movies is about playing not so mentally healthy people really beautifully.
They're not – maybe not so mentally healthy, but I didn't look at any of these characters as unhealthy. I thought they were all absolute geniuses in their own way. And I think they're great human people. Now, if I can hang my hat on humanity, I'm going to find what I think is some genius and be honest. I think Rustin Cole – I loved living in Rustin Cole's head. You may say this guy has got real problems, but he doesn't deal with mendacity or bull himself one iota. Now, is that a hard place to live? You're damn right.
Yeah.
We con ourselves daily to get through the day and we slough off some things and say, I'll let that slide.
Yeah.
Well, what if you didn't let anything slide and you called everything as exactly what it is. Yes. And what is it? Huh, be a long day, man.
Liar, liar, not as a comedy.
It would be a long day. So, you know, I mean, look, I'll say this as well, and I think this is an aphorism that goes along with what you're saying. The more secure a man feels at home, the higher and wider he can fly outside of it. You know, I have more security at home. I have a great wife. I have three children. Those are incredibly grounding things that are a natural law. At any moment, at any time in life, whatever's going on, if it has something to do with the family, that immediately takes first place. You know what I mean? So to have that, I'm able – it definitely gives me courage to go out and go, hey, man, I'm gonna fly.
Matthew McConaughey, thank you very much.
You're welcome. I enjoyed it.
Matthew McConaughey is currently in Wolf of Wall Street and True Detective on HBO, and he's been nominated for an Oscar for his performance in Dallas Buyers Club. You can hear a lot more of our conversation, including a career word association game I had a lot of fun playing with. That's at Studio360.org.
It's the man in the moon come from Texas. That is where.
For 15 years, Joss Whedon has been a pop cult hero to a generation who consider Buffy the Vampire Slayer, the TV show he created, to have been the defining, most profoundly entertaining TV show of their generation.
Oh, why can't you people just leave me alone?
Because you are the Slayer. Into each generation, a Slayer is born. One girl in all the world, a chosen one, one born with
the strength and skill to hunt the vampires, to stop the spread of their evil blah, blah, blah. I've heard it, okay?
I really don't understand.
But it turns out Buffy was just Joss Whedon's first brass ring. About 100 million people have seen his adaptation of the Avengers comic book since it came out a year ago, making him the writer-director of the second biggest movie of the 21st century. So what does he do for a follow-up this summer? He invites a bunch of friends over to his house, opens a lot of wine, and films a 400-year-old play. Whedon's new movie is Much Ado About Nothing, Shakespeare's romantic comedy about couples coming together, breaking apart, and coming back together again.
Do not you love me?
Why, no. No more than reason.
Why, then, your uncle and the prince and Claudio have been deceived. They swore you did.
Do not you love me?
Troth, no, no. More than reason?
Why, then, my cousin, Margaret and Ursula, are much deceived, for they did swear you did.
Most of the film's stars he'd worked with before in TV shows like Firefly and Angel. I'd heard that Whedon made the film while he was working on The Avengers, in between shooting and post-production.
That is true. We started filming a month after we wrapped The Avengers.
Just because you need to keep yourself stressed out and overworked all the time?
You know, it was my wife's idea. She knew that the best vacation I could possibly take after a fairly grueling shoot was to create something with my dear friends that I loved very much, in the house that I loved very much, with a text that I've loved since I was a kid. It was the least stressed out I've ever been.
Really?
Except for the neighbor's yappy dog.
So this, I'm presuming, cost maybe 1% of what the Avengers cost to make?
Probably. I'm not sure we achieved an entire percent.
And you're happy with the way it turned out? I got to say, I went, Joss Whedon doing Much Ado? Maybe. And it was my wife and I practically skipped out of the theater in delight.
I'm so pleased. You know, the thing I was nervous about was, you know, can I pull this off? Partially because, you know, Shakespeare is, you know, he's unapologetic about where he's going with the text. He doesn't, you know, it's not a smooth ride. He's very populist, but he's like, I'm going to go to this very dark drama. I'm going to stay here for a long time.
In this comedy.
Right, exactly. And then I'm going to go to the lowest comedy in the entire thing. Like, he'll just bounce back and forth.
Come, bind them. Thou naughty varlet.
Wait, you are an ass. You are an ass.
Does that not suspect my place? Does that not suspect my years?
And while I appreciate that kind of bipolar filmmaking, it made me a little nervous.
That's funny. You could be the executive giving notes to Shakespeare.
I was very happy not to be able to.
And you shot the movie in your house and your backyard in Santa Monica. Was that just because that was comfortable and familiar?
First of all, my wife built that house, and I knew from the moment I set foot in it that I would want to film something there. And because it's all in one place, that place informs the mood and the feeling and the look of the picture so much, and I was really already comfortable with that. And plus, location scouts were a breeze.
You play it ultimately so straight. So I'm interested in the choices you did make. For instance, they drink a lot. And was that just something from the beginning? Yeah, they should be boozing it up all the time?
We referred to the house as the Kennedy compound a lot of the time, where everybody's incredibly elegant, but they're drinking before noon, and the party gets a little out of control, and you kind of just go, maybe I should have left before the wedding. And we wanted to sort of compress it and make it feel like this hothouse of slight debauchery. And so it would feel like that modern idea of the way these people, these rich and powerful people live.
Even though they are living in this absolutely contemporary place, wearing suits and ties, which is another interesting choice, but speaking Shakespeare, were there lines you cut for dramatic or intelligibility reasons?
I mean, there's a huge chunk of the text that's out because it's a very long play. The only lines, there was a reference to a rubato that I changed to a gown, and the most important one being, after careful consideration, I decided not to have Benedict say, if I do not love her, I am a Jew. I thought, okay, you know what? I'm going to rewrite Shakespeare once in my life. Let's just make it fool.
This, I guess, is your first project without any supernatural elements. You could have gone supernatural with Hamlet or Midsummer Night's Dream or something. Was it a liberating pleasure to deal with people who had no special powers?
You know, it's not a priority with me. It's an argument I've had with my stepfather over the years. Every time I came to New York, he'd be like, when are you going to make a real grown-up picture without the vampires and the rocket ships? And I was like, never. It's never going to happen. And then, you know, less than a year after he died, boom. I'm like, ah, okay, he's right. But I didn't pick it because it doesn't have those things. I mean, at the end of the day, all I'm ever doing is telling stories about people, and whether or not I need some VFX or fake fangs to do that,
right?
It's the same story.
It has been a decade since Buffy went off the air. The Buffy cult, however, remains preternaturally strong. And now I see there's an academic journal devoted to it with articles like The Justice Systems of Slayers and Vengeance Demons, Prosecutorial Discretion in Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Is this the fact that there is a field of Buffy studies please you?
It pleases me to no end. I mean, how could it offend me?
Yeah.
Everything we did with enormous thought and care in terms of not only, you know, what the story was, but what it meant.
Right.
And, you know, there are definitely aspects of it that, you know, we didn't think of that people pick up on. But that's true for any story. And the fact that this moves people to sort of go into that field, that they want to sort of break these things down. It's the best compliment.
Because you took it seriously, now they're taking it seriously.
Yeah. And, you know, we didn't expect other people to. We thought, we'll take it seriously, but we won't tell anyone.
You are a third-generation TV writer. Maybe there are others, but I find that amazing. Your father wrote Captain Kangaroo and The Electric Company. Your grandfather wrote Donna Reed, Andy Griffith, Leave It to Beaver. Essentially every show I ever watched growing up. Did you ever resist going into the family business?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. No. Television was beneath me because I'm an artist. And my best friend used to taunt me. He was like, you're going to be a third-generation television writer. And his nickname was like 3GTV. I was like, shut up.
That's
3GTV.
Funny.
Yeah. And I was like, never. It felt like stepping down. I didn't watch a lot of American TV growing up. I watched mostly the BBC. I lived with my mom. She was a snob. I'm not going to lie. And and then I was broke, and suddenly I saw things differently.
Why do you think comic books as source material have become so gigantic in the culture in a way they have never been?
I think they really are the sort of 20th century mythos, and, you know, we grew up with that, we old people now. You know, what the comic book brought, which was this very Shakespearean drama, this very high king's world and betrayal and love and pain and every month and, you know, bigger than life but grounded in life. It speaks to us, and I think that, you know, the people it spoke to the most are now running studios.
And when you make this $600-odd million grossing movie, is there any moment where you go like, nah, I don't want to do that again? I spent years and thousands of hours devoted to that. Enough.
Yeah, there are many moments. There are very few of the other kind. But the story starts to tickle the back of your head. And when it does, you sort of go, well, what if? And my what if kind of exploded in my brain. I realized, oh, I actually, now that I've got the hang of it, now that I feel comfortable in this world, and I don't mean the Marvel world so much as the sort of making a big budget movie
right.
world, I felt like, okay, now the next time I can really sit down to make a film, maybe a better film than the one I made last time. And it's a very new challenge.
And presumably you now, since it worked out so well, have the leverage with the money guys to, they say, Joss, whatever you say, you're the genius now.
Well, happily, they don't say that. They definitely, you know, if things are on the fence, they fall on the side of trust, which is nice. But they're still making a huge investment, and they're still going to have opinions about things. And the people in Marvel are people that I love working for and respect. And when somebody gives you that much money, you listen to them.
For sure.
And the day you stop is the day you stop being a good storyteller.
Joss Whedon, keep telling stories. A pleasure talking to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Joss Whedon's Much Ado About Nothing is in theaters right now. Do you happen to remember the Academy Awards of 7 years ago? March 2003. The Iraq War had begun exactly 3 days earlier.
Well, I'm glad they cut back on all the glitz. You probably noticed there was no fancy red carpet tonight. That'll send them a message.
That was Steve Martin in 2003. He'll co-host this weekend ceremony with Alec Baldwin. Over the last 7 years, there have been quite a few movies about the Iraq War, Stop Loss, In the Valley of Ella, Grace is Gone, all of them earnest attempts. But none was great, and none was a commercial success either. Finally, we've got a great Iraq War film that at least a couple of million Americans have paid to see so far, The Hurt Locker. Now, it's no coincidence that The Hurt Locker is, one, a suspenseful action picture, and two, takes no easy political position on the war. Set in 2004, just as the insurgency was starting to heat up, The Hurt Locker follows a bomb unit as they defuse IEDs all over Baghdad. Academy Award nominee Jeremy Renner plays Sergeant William James.
What's he doing?
I don't know. What are you doing?
There's enough banging there to send us all to Jesus. I'm gonna die. I wanna die comfortable.
Hurt Locker was written by Mark Bull, who was an embedded journalist in Iraq. And the handheld cameras and visceral combat sequences are the distinctive work of the director Catherine Bigelow. She's only the fourth woman ever nominated for Best Director. If you're making an Iraq war film, the standard thing to do is shoot it thousands of miles away in peaceful Morocco. But Hurt Locker was mostly shot in Jordan, right near the Iraq border. I asked Bigelow why.
Wanted to be as close to the war zone as we possibly could.
Because that's so fun?
Actually, Barry and I at one point wanted to, we were so close to the border, Barry Ackroyd, the cinematographer, wanted to shoot some photography in Iraq, but their security detail said it couldn't guarantee our safety because of snipers. So we stayed in Jordan. And the great bonus that neither of us anticipated were the Iraqi refugees, which were probably upwards of about 750,000 at the time when we were shooting. And so I immediately incorporated them into all the background extras and the speaking
really?
Parts, many of whom were actually actors in Baghdad. So that was, he probably thought they would never act again. If you remember the sequence in the desert, two of them were actually POWs, had been in Baghdad. And they were now playing POWs in this movie. So,
the prisoners that Ralph Fiennes and his band were actually POWs.
Yes.
Good
yes.
God. This is going to seem like a stupid question, I suppose, but wasn't it really hot?
Well, not as hot as Kuwait. We scouted Kuwait prior to going to Jordan, and that was insane. The temperatures at the time we were there was about 135 degrees. In Jordan, it was about, you know, it was a mild, maybe 115, 120. So,
and your main character has this big, what must be a hellish bomb suit on.
That was the biggest challenge. Jeremy Renner, who is just, I think, one of the most talented actors of his generation, along with Anthony Mackie and Brian Garrity, I will say. Anyway, that was a real bomb suit made of Kevlar and ceramic plates, weighs approximately 100 pounds. And then you add to that the helmet, which limits your oxygen. That was fairly harrowing in and of itself.
Most of the leads in this film are not very well known, but you have three very well-known actors in very brief, small roles, Guy Pearce and David Morse and Ralph Fiennes. How did that happen?
So my thinking was, if it's a very well-known face in your lead role, you're going to anticipate, well, he can't die, he's a hero, he can't die till
exactly,
the end.
Exactly.
You know, it's, or not die at all.
Yeah.
And so when you take that out of the equation, and the playing field is anything can happen, which in fact is what it's like in Baghdad, that was very important.
Watching the movie, I was sometimes reminded of your film Strange Days, the science fiction thriller from 1995. In its camera work, among other things, it also takes place in a kind of war zone, although in Los Angeles, and it also starred Ralph Fiennes, who plays Lanny Nero, who's an ex-cop selling a sort of futuristic virtual reality device to thrill seekers and junkies. I want to play a clip of Ralph Fiennes in that film describing the experience.
Now listen, I want you to know what we're talking about here, okay? This is not like TV, only better. This is life. It's a piece of somebody's life. It's pure and uncut. It's straight from the cerebral cortex. I mean, you're there, you're doing it. You're seeing it, you're hearing it, you're feeling it.
What kind of things, exactly?
It's about the stuff that you can't have, right? The forbidden fruit, Like running into a liquor store with a .357 Magnum in your hand, feeling the adrenaline pumping through your veins,
So that character is selling this sort of addictive thrill, which is to some degree what The Hurt Locker is about as well, yeah?
You know, I don't think you can do a movie today about this conflict or any conflict that Americans are involved with without addressing the fact that it's an all-volunteer military.
Meaning that they've chosen to go do this for better, for whatever combination of reasons.
Exactly. Like these individuals, these members of the EOD, who arguably have the most dangerous job in the world, are there by choice. And yet, what is the personal price that they're paying?
What do we have here?
They're, bomb parts, signatures.
Yeah, I see that, but what are they doing under your bed?
Well, this one, y'all, is from our first call together. This box is full of stuff that almost killed me.
What about this one? Where's this one from, Will?
It's my wedding ring. Like I said, stuff that almost killed me.
There are some incredibly beautiful brief shots of explosions in this film. Does that come from your sort of artist past? You were a painter and you studied art as a young person.
I did. And, you know, it's a real challenge not to get, for me anyway, as a filmmaker, not to be too seduced by the visual.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very seductive surface, but to go past that surface and, of course, you know, begin to mine the substance. But on those sequences that you're mentioning, we shot the movie predominantly with these beautiful French cameras, which are very small and dexterous. But those sequences that you mentioned that are kind of almost a granular, no pun intended, unpacking of what a bomb detonation might be like, we used a digital camera called a phantom camera, and it shoots 10,000 frames a second. So it takes any given event and breaks it down to its sort of granular infrastructure. And that comes from speaking to bomb techs, and they talk about overpressure that precedes the particulate matter of any given detonation. That overpressure is basically the air moving out of the way for the particulate matter to then be expended. And the air alone travels at such an incredible velocity that it literally collapses any air pocket in your body instantaneously. Way before shrapnels hit you or an object has hit you.
Sanborn! Butcher shop, 2 o'clock, dude has a phone!
Why is Eldridge running?
Make him put it down!
Put down the phone!
Come on, guys, talk to me.
Drop the phone!
Burn out!
Put down the cell phone!
Burn out! Get out of the way!
Drop your phone!
Put it down! Go get it!
I can't get a shot!
How did you go from being a young painter in New York City to being this director of action movies?
How did it happen? I think that I was in the art world. I was working actually as a conceptual artist with a group of artists. Oh, this is going to sound so erudite. But anyway, trying to not have culture be so commodified.
This is in the 1970s.
This is in the 70s, exactly. And then I was looking at why film is so captivating. In other words, how do you break that fourth wall? And so it kind of found, I always sort of think of it as it found me. I didn't even know it was called directing, what I was doing. I was just exploring an idea, but I was using film as the medium for that exploration.
But was it the interest in telling longer stories that attracted you, or the interest in having millions of people rather than thousands or hundreds of people see it?
Well, there you have it. See, I was also, I knew Andy Warhol a bit at the time, and I don't say that as a, you know, to drop names. I don't mean it that way. But
yeah.
The thing that was so extraordinary about him and his work is it was incredibly intellectual work that was very populist simultaneously.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a paradigm shift for me. You know, that was like, wait a minute, you can, you know, it's a Brillo box in a very beautiful art gallery,
mm-hmm.
yet it was an incredible political statement, this idea of something being accessible. You could just fall in, you know, fall out of the street into a theater, watch something, and have it wash over you. And then you leave the theater and suddenly you're thinking about something. That, to me, that's as good as it gets.
Catherine Bigelow, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
I appreciate it.
The new Sandra Bullock, George Clooney space movie, Gravity, really is unlike anything I've ever seen. There are these incredible long shots that capture amazing action, and that action isn't as crazy and outsized and maximal as other special effects blockbusters, but it packs way more punch.
Houston, this is mission specialist Ryan Stone. I am off structure and I'm drifting. Do you copy? Anyone?
Gravity was directed and co-written by Alfonso Cuarón, who previously made A Little Princess, Y Tu Mamá También, one of the Harry Potter movies, and Children of Men, which means he is a guy who does not repeat himself. Alfonso Cuarón, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you, Kurt.
The action in Gravity is relentless, and these space panoramas are amazing. But what's interesting is, as a film, it's sort of small and austere. And there are no cuts to Earth in Mission Control. You almost don't see Earth during the film. Just a couple of people alone in space with this simple story. Was that the notion from the beginning?
Yeah, no, that was the idea was that it's almost a metaphorical journey. Outer space is a metaphor of the inner space of our character. So in that sense, there's a certain intimacy about the whole thing. As Jonas Cuarón, my co-writer, kept on saying, in one hand has to do this roller coaster.
Who is a relative of yours, by the way.
Yeah, he's my son. Yeah, little detail. It has to be a roller coaster of a ride filled with suspense and tension. But by the same token, it has to be this emotional journey. One has to inform the other. We cannot be stopping to have now our dramatic moment and then cut to the chase, but everything has to be all together and organic. We defined that the thematic of the film was about adversities. Adversities takes you out of your comfort zone, tend to make you drift, and you can start drifting into the void, not unlike our character. So it was through this process that we were planning this journey, that this roller coaster ride, that all that thematic element is expressed through visual metaphors.
So when you start off with this story in which the actors are going to be floating in space the whole time, something that has never been filmed for a whole movie before, how long did you think it would take to get it made?
I always say that it was a miscalculation. I finished the screenplay and I thought it was going to be something very straightforward with a fair amount of visual effects. And it was not until we start kind of grounding the screenplay into how we're going to do it that we realized that the technology didn't exist to make the film we wanted to make. A long journey of invention and research began.
And as you were going through that process, did you and your partners ever think about giving up?
It was a whole journey of discovery. So you just keep on learning and failing and having great finds. And so it was a process of exhilaration and frustration.
With practically every big movie now loaded with visual effects, it's kind of hard to amaze audiences. But in Gravity, you do it straight out of the box. The first shot is almost a quarter hour long. Was that always the intention, open the movie with one super long continuous shot?
Well, that was the suggestion already from the screenplay. And the goal of that first shot was first to observe everything objectively, the way that you would observe an IMAX documentary. And then you see a routine mission with some astronauts doing some work.
And just doing small talk as they do.
Small talk and stuff. And eventually the camera, when disaster strikes, our character starts running away into the void. The camera keeps on following this character objectively until there's a point in which the camera finally locks with the character. And now the camera is rolling together with the character.
Right.
Eventually, the camera goes into the POV of the character. And the whole theory is that once that we come out of that POV, the camera is not objective, is not subjective. The camera is the POV of the audience. So we have now the audience journeying in space with the other astronauts. And I'm happy people talk about the long shot deals and stuff, but for me that's a little irrelevant. It's not the look, mama, no hands kind of shot. You know, every shot has its meaning and its purpose. This film would be a completely shallow if it was not for the biggest visual effect here, that is the performance of Sandra Bullock.
In order to pull off this visual trick of actors looking as though they're floating in zero gravity the whole time, you had to film them in these extremely controlled contraptions with actors on wires and mechanical rigs and computer-controlled lights everywhere. Did Sandra Bullock and George Clooney have any flexibility to act?
Well, the big challenge for the actors was that everything was pre-programmed. Pre-programmed robots that were carrying the camera and the lights, and the pre-programmed rigs for the actors that they were actually very straining for them. And the room for change was minimum.
So they were just extras in the robot picture.
Well, not it's the opposite, because the important thing here was more like a ballet, in which the actors, they have to memorize a very precise choreography. It was an exercise about abstraction, because they were performing against nothing. So the beauty of that is that they rehearsed so much that when we were in the set, everything was just about performance. Again, like a dancer that when he's finally on stage, all of that hard work is secondhand to the expression.
It's also, naturally, this film in 3D, and it's maybe the first film I've seen since Avatar where I thought, like, this used 3D in a fantastic way. Also, the sound is a very 3D experience. I want to play a clip where things start going bad and this storm of dead satellites is hurtling toward the characters and their shuttle.
We have to go. We have to go, go, go.
Kennedy reports meteorological conditions. Go, go.
Houston, Explorer, copy.
Explorer, Dr. Stone requesting faster transport to Bay Area. Explorer, do you copy?
Explorer, permission to retrieve Dr. Stone.
Your go, Quan. Houston, Explorer, copy.
All right.
We've lost Houston.
Look, we need to get the hell out of here.
Need some help there, man.
No, don't wait for us.
It's stuck.
Man down.
That was George Clooney and Sandra Bullock dealing with space chaos in Gravity. How did you approach making a sound-rich movie in, of course, what is absolutely silent space?
Well, the actual sound effects, we were very literal about following the rules of physics, that there's no sound in space. You can hear whenever there's an interaction between our character and objects, because the vibrations would travel to the ear and the brain. But then we use music. There was this German composer called Stockhausen, and Stockhausen had these pieces in which audiences were in the hall, but the orchestra was not on stage. It was scattered around the hall. And when the music started, they start playing, but then they start moving around. And it would create these dynamics, and that's what we tried to reproduce with the surround sound.
You could afford to take up one of Richard Branson's Virgin Galactic flights next year when they start. Will you do that?
If your station sponsors me, I'll be so happy. We can do a direct link when I'm up
really?
There.
We can start a Kickstarter get the $250,000?
Exactly, yeah.
Well, let's talk about that. When people talk about your films, they mention, you say, there are all of these long, slow, real-time tracking shots in Y Tu Mamá También, in Children of Men, now in this. Did you start doing that partly as a reaction to what was happening in the 80s as you were growing up and this quick cut thing became the way movies are the new cinematic language?
I enjoy montage. I enjoy editing. I don't have a riff with that. I have a riff against point of view. It's just a lot of footage put together and trying to create certain energy and stuff with a lot of cuts.
And they're just cutting the music or whatever.
And that bothers me quite a lot. Another thing that I've been exploring with Lubezki, the director of photography for many films now, is this tension between character and context and environment. So character and environment, they have the same weight. You know, so that's the reason I don't favor close-up that much.
One of the movies you made before everybody knew who you were and you were a big famous movie director was A Little Princess, based on the novel by Frances Hodgson Burnett. I want to play a short clip from it in which the main character is defending her imagination and princesshood.
I am a princess. All girls are. Even if they live in tiny old attics, even if they dress in rags, even if they aren't pretty or smart or young, they're still princesses. All of us. Didn't your father ever tell you that? Didn't he?
That was from A Little Princess, 1995. A lot of people, including my daughters, still love that film. And I read that it's your favorite of all your films?
Ever since I finished my films, I never see them again.
I read that too, which is interesting.
But this one is, I just have a very good memory out of it and the energy of that film.
And I also read that unlike authors who say, consider every novel their baby or filmmakers, every movie is my child, not you. You say that they're like your ex-wife.
Yeah. They gave me so much. I gave them so much. We love each other so much, but now we parted ways. We don't see each other. If my ex-wife is in trouble, obviously I would go immediately.
So they weren't acrimonious divorces?
You know, No. It's just the same here. If suddenly I know that my negative is going to be burned, yeah, I try to go and rescue it.
So you've done the princess movie, the adaptation of a classic, the coming-of-age movie, the franchise installment, the dystopian sci-fi film, now this visual effects spectacular. Do you have like a genre checklist and you just check, next one?
No, that would be maybe that would be helpful because it's one of those things you just do what you think is the right thing to do.
And what's the right next thing? And will it be once more something unlike what you've done before?
Probably. I never thought, it's because I don't really revisit my films, so I don't really know much about what they have in common or not.
Well, I can remind you what you've done before if you want.
No, please don't.
Alfonso Cuarón, thank you very much.
Hey, thank you, Kurt. Thank you very much. It was fun.
Alfonso Cuarón made the movie Gravity, which is open everywhere. You may or may not know the name Sarah Polley, but I guarantee you, starting now, you're going to. She is a phenomenal talent. She started acting professionally at age 6, and in the 22 years since, she has appeared in more than 30 movies, including Atom Egoyan's film The Sweet Hereafter, in which Sarah Polley starred when she was just 16.
I don't like thinking about the accident. I don't even remember it happening. Besides, it just makes people feel sorry for me, and...
You hate that.
Now, at age 28, she's done what successful, ambitious actors tend to do when they're 38 or 48, become a director. Sarah Polley's first feature film is called Away From Her. It stars a certified legendary movie star, Julie Christie. It is the story of Grant and Fiona, an aging couple who struggle to maintain their relationship when Fiona begins to fall ill with Alzheimer's. Here is a scene early in the movie when Fiona and Grant are reading up on Alzheimer's.
I can't even see what the point is. We can't be certain this is what it... You're far too young.
Should the patient afflicted with the disease remain at home, the caregiver will very often be the spouse. The caregiver must preside over the degeneration of someone he or she loves very much. Must do this for years and years with the news always getting worse, not better. Must put up sometimes with deranged, but at the same time very personal insults. And must somehow learn to smile through it all. Imagine the person you love the most suddenly upset about something, but completely unable to communicate the problem or even to understand it himself. Sounds like a regular marriage.
So why did you want to make a movie whose main character has Alzheimer's?
And for me, it was about love and guilt, and it was very much about a portrait of a marriage. In that exchange that you just played, I mean, I think it's so interesting when you read about Alzheimer's disease, how many metaphors keep occurring to you about a marriage itself. And that was something that, you know, a passage that I had read in a book. All of a sudden I thought, God, this is as though describing a relationship in a way.
What drew you to a love story, though, about a couple old enough to be your grandparents?
Well, it's based on a short story by Alice Munro called The Bear Came Over the Mountain. And I read that story about 5 or 6 years ago. And was so profoundly moved by it, and felt like it was so much more interesting to focus on a relationship after 44 years than it is at the beginning. And I think most of the love stories we see on screen are, you know, people in their teens or 20s who don't know themselves or each other all that well, and what happens is not actually all that complex.
So you're bored by people like you.
Not so much. No, I mean, and there's something to be said for those stories. I mean, there's something to be said for watching them, and they're captivating, but. I thought it was sort of strange that I'd very rarely seen love stories about people who were older and who had, you know, had life happen to them and failures happen to them.
Your husband is a film editor and edited this film.
Yes, he did, yeah.
People obviously say, oh, you're never supposed to work with your spouse. What were your rough patches doing this movie together? You were his boss.
Well, I'm not sure about that. But it was an amazing experience. I mean, it's crazy when you describe it, because literally I was, you know, locked in a dark room with my husband for 3 months editing a film about a marriage. So all we talked about was marriage and these two other fictional people's relationship. It was like bizarre therapy.
Yeah.
But it was also fantastic, right? Because you end up kind of talking around things that you might not literally. And there's also this fantastic arrangement where you are not allowed to walk away from a disagreement, because at the end of the day, a film has to get delivered. It was amazing. It was amazing for us, I think.
You clearly, just talking to you a little bit, seeing you on the screen, looking at your incredible 30-odd movie resume, are a ferociously ambitious person, yeah?
It's weird. I always think of myself as really lazy and totally unambitious. It's strange. Yeah. The word ambition is so strange. I always feel like culturally in Canada, the word ambition can be like, you know, the kind of thing. Like, I know when anyone in my family or friends uses the word ambitious, it's always like with a real like edge to it. It's like the worst insult you could deliver to somebody.
Because you're like an American?
So I'm always, I don't know. Just a sense of like climbing or needing to get somewhere. And so I like to think of myself as not ambitious at all. But I suppose I'm driven, you know, and I don't know.
Ambition's a good thing. You're in the United States.
Okay, I'm in America now.
Exactly. You are Canadian and sort of proudly Canadian. Away From Her is based on a short story by the great Canadian writer, Alice Munro. Filmed it in Ontario.
Yeah.
Co-stars the great Canadian actor, Gordon Pinsent. Why do you feel in this globalized 21st century moment committed to Canada as an idea?
Because, you know, if we're not really committed to the idea of Canada, it probably ceases to exist. I mean, we live right next door to the biggest superpower in the world, a country that, you know, culturally dominates a lot of the world. And I think that there's a really interesting tradition of Canadian, you know, writers and filmmakers and artists that is fundamentally different than Americans.
So beyond the politics and the single-payer health care and all that stuff, you think there are significant cultural differences?
Well, I feel like in a nutshell, there's more of an emphasis on the collective than the individual. Freedom and liberty of the individual is not as important as the good of the community.
And I guess the annoying side of that is that ambition is,
yes,
is,
it
is
comes
an invidious
back, exactly.
idea.
It comes back to like ambition being a scary word for us.
Yeah.
Not all of us. A couple of us.
As much as you're a Canadian patriot, you have also been a big critic of the Canadian film system over the years. What is the problem there?
The problem is we don't have access to our own films in Canada, so it's impossible to nurture and grow an industry in the same way we did with music. The way we did it with music is we said 30 years ago that 30 or 40% of all music played on Canadian radio has to be Canadian.
Right.
And because we did that, we started listening to our music and those artists were nurtured, and now we have an extremely successful and thriving music industry. We have no similar protection in film. So, you know, a Canadian independent film might play at a tiny little theater for like a week in Toronto and then be gone. And all of the other screens are taken up with huge American blockbusters. From our perspective, it means we don't get access to our own culture, which is hugely problematic.
You have been an actress for most of your life, more than 20 years now. Did all of that work as an actress prepare you for directing?
That's a really interesting question. And I think that for me, the shocking thing was the illusion that I knew anything about the filmmaking process. Because, in fact, you can learn very little as an actor about the filmmaking process.
They don't want you to
know
stuff,
right?
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's like you learn very quickly when you're making a film. It's 95% of everybody's job to protect the actor from all pertinent information.
Right.
It's like part of the culture of a film set. So there are actors that transcend that and learn a lot anyway. I wasn't one of them. So the whole concept of, you know, editing and the technical aspects of it and to be able to think visually and organize a day, that was all stuff that I kind of had to teach myself through my short films that I didn't feel I'd really learned as an actor.
So being a director is like being the parent suddenly instead of the child.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Your parents were both actors.
Mm-hmm.
Did they think this was a good idea to pursue this career?
You know, my memory of it is that I really wanted to act when I was 4 or 5, desperately, so much so that even though they knew that was not a great thing for a child, they finally relented. I believe that to be true. It's my memory of it. It's also what Shirley Temple will tell you and every former child actor will tell you. And I think none of us are lying and none of us are selling a bill of goods, but I'm deeply suspicious of the story. Now, I don't think they shoved me into it, but I do think that there was very quickly a time where I would have been much happier to be in school and didn't know that I could articulate that, actually.
Huh.
Like, that if I had, I'm certain they would have put me in school and there would have been no problem. I just think you don't know as a child, you know, what your options are. You don't know to cast away something that makes your parents so proud of you.
Was there a moment when you were a kid when you saw something that made you think, I really do like this. I really want to do this well?
I think it was working with Adam Egoyan when I guess I was 17 and did The Sweet Hereafter. And, you know, I'd done it my whole life and been an actor my whole life and never really understood it. It seemed like such a superficial thing to do with your life. And I was much more interested in politics. And I think it was watching him make that film and then seeing that film that made me realize, you know, film is something that can be kind of transcendent. It's something that can shift people and change their minds and make them think. And it's possible to express ideas in an extremely effective way. I mean, I think you always take your family for granted, right? So that's what I grew up in. I was always around filmmaking, and I think I had to sort of come back to it on my own terms and rediscover it.
Sarah Polley, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. There is a town in
North Ontario. Sarah Polley's film Away From Her is playing in theaters across the country right now. Yeah. And now, from the world's newest graffiti to the world's oldest, cave art. It's the subject of Werner Herzog's new film, Cave of Forgotten Dreams. Herzog is the most idiosyncratic and one of the most interesting major filmmakers working today. He's made big epic features like Fitzcarraldo and more recently Rescue Dawn with Christian Bale, but he's almost as well known for his peculiar and riveting documentaries like Grizzly Man. His new movie is also a documentary, but the wild animals in it are painted on cave walls.
In a forbidden recess of the cave, there's a footprint of an 8-year-old boy next to the footprint of a wolf. Did a hungry wolf stalk the boy? Or did they walk together as friends? Or were their tracks made thousands of years apart? We'll never know.
Cave of Forgotten Dreams chronicles the oldest paintings on Earth in 3D. For my money, the result may be the best use of 3D technology yet.
I was skeptical and I'm still skeptical about 3D. It's not the wisdom of all wisdoms. There are films that still should be in 2D. And the moment I set my foot into the cage, it was clear, yes, it had to be in 3D. It was imperative. This cave, which was discovered, contained paintings that were way, way, way earlier, more than twice as early as anything we had ever seen, and completely and utterly accomplished. I mean, great art. It's not like primitive children's sort of stuff. Completely and utterly accomplished.
And one of the things that one sees, partly because it's 3D and you talk about it, is that the surfaces and the contours of the stone are used in the art.
Yeah, there are wild bulges and rock pendants and niches, and the artists utilized it. For example, a bulge in the formation of the rock now is a bulging neck of a bison that charges you. So very, very interesting how they utilized the drama of the three dimensions.
The logistics beyond the 3D cameras and so forth of filming in this cave were extremely constrained, yeah?
Yes, sure. You have to understand the famous cave of Lascaux with the famous horses and wonderful paintings, which were done something like 14,000 years roughly back in time, had to be shut down for good because too many visitors were inside.
Right, almost 50 years ago they were shut down.
Yes, and all the breath, all the exhalations, all the vapors from human beings created a mold on the walls. So the Chauvet cave was left as a complete, perfect time capsule. And you must not leave, ever step off a 2-foot-wide metal walkway. You don't put a tripod down there, so you do not install a light. You do not touch anything, because right next to you, you see fairly fresh tracks of cave bears. But the cave bears became extinct some 20,000 years ago, and you still have the fresh tracks.
Amazing.
There. Yes.
A beautiful horse here, one of the most beautiful in the cave. And what is touching is that it looks as if it had been done yesterday. Look how fresh it looks with that technique.
The constraints, you couldn't go off this little metal walkway, yeah. And 4 hours a day for 6 days, not much
yes,
time
that
at all.
Yes, yeah. And only three persons with me.
Right.
And you see quite often the crew at work is in frame because there's no way to hide behind the camera.
Right.
You see us working and holding the lights.
With this film, as I was watching it, I thought of your Antarctic film, Encounters at the End of the World. I thought of Lessons of Darkness, where you shoot the oil well fires that the Saddam
yes.
Hussein's troops lit at the end of the first Gulf War. Your documentaries often are of this Earth as though you've come from some other planet to sort of look at this strange world with some greater objectivity or something?
Well, I think it's not greater objectivity, but when you looked at Kuwait, when all the fires were still burning, every single oil well was burning, And I mean gigantic fires. They shoot up 300 feet into the air. They would roar like four jet planes taking off at the same time. In the film that I made, there's not a single shot, not one shot, where you could recognize our planet anymore. It was as if you were filming on a different planet.
And he opened the bottomless pit, and there arose a smoke out of the pit, as the smoke of a great furnace. And the sun and the air were darkened by reason of the smoke. And in those days shall men seek death, and shall not find it, and shall desire to die, and death shall flee from them.
There was something cosmic about it, something way beyond the political events. And this is why the film never mentions Saddam Hussein, never mentions Iraq or Kuwait. It is as if we were witnessing something like a crime against creation itself, something way beyond politics.
Yeah. This film is, compared to many of your films, it seems to me, unambiguously full of uplift and amazement and kind of celebration of the human spirit.
Oh, yes.
I mean, there's very little of the, on the other hand, let me tell you something dark that you often do in your films.
Not that I'm seeking out a dark side in other films.
But there's plenty of darkness in the world.
Yes, and sometimes a darkness presents itself and becomes evident when you look at Grizzly Man, for example. Yes, wild nature is not something like Walt Disney would invent it.
Yes.
And a grizzly bear over 1,000 pounds, an animal that can decapitate you with one swipe of its paw, that runs as fast as a horse and can move 250 miles in 48 hours.
They're not little cute.
They're not just fluffy and cute and friendly, and you don't sing to them. You don't love the bear. Respect the bear and respect its territory.
In Cave of Forgotten Dreams, one of the interesting things is that apparently no one lived here, right? It was some kind of art gallery, religious place, who knows? But there was not a domestic center.
No, it was not inhabited by human beings, although you have evidence of fires, but they were used not for cooking or warming yourself. They were used for illumination. We know that. Besides, the prehistoric entrance was fairly wide and large, so daylight would come in, but the paintings you would find deep, deep, deep into the recesses of the cave, where it was definitely dark day and night.
So it's a movie theater with
almost, yes.
With flame making it dance.
Yes, and torches, moving torches that made them dance. We actually tried to recreate this effect a little bit, or we would move our lights and all of a sudden the shadow of a niche would move along with a light. And it gave a very strong sense of how images probably have been seen at that time. Dwarfed by these large chambers, illuminated by our wandering lights, sometimes we were overcome by a strange, irrational sensation, as if we were disturbing the Paleolithic people in their work. It felt like eyes upon us.
As you went down there and spent a week looking at these paintings, did one or more of them strike you as your favorites?
Yes, there are a couple, but maybe the most stunning for me are the lions. There's an ensemble of lions stalking something, and with an incredible intensity of gaze, they're all looking exactly at the same spot, and we don't see what they are stalking. So there's such a drama and such an intensity in these paintings. I've never experienced it anywhere in any painting.
That's interesting. That really does rise to the level of art.
Yeah, of course. Any idiot spending less than 120 seconds in front of these paintings would know this is great. This is very, very big, what we are seeing there. Whether it was understood as art for the painters 32,000 years ago, we do not know. The painters of the cave seem to speak to us from a familiar yet distant universe. But what we are seeing here is part of millions of spatial points.
When, I'm sure you've experienced this, sometimes with your documentaries, when your narration comes up, because you have such a specific, recognizable voice and saying these sometimes very grand statements, there's laughter sometimes.
Yes, there's a humor in it, sure, yes.
You're entirely aware of that?
Of course, yes. And in many of my films, there's much more humor than you would ever anticipate. But yeah, when you see them with an audience, there's a lot of laughter.
Yes.
And I enjoy it. Finally, they notice.
Oh, that's great. One of your newer projects is something you call the Rogue Film School, which is a 4-day seminar that you run. How did that come about, and what takes place there?
It's not like a regular film school. I encourage everyone to learn how to pick a safety lock, how to forge a shooting permit. But that's only at the surface. But otherwise, it's very much about a way of life also. Of course, I also encourage everyone, read. If you don't read, you will never be a filmmaker, never be a real good one.
How interesting. So you have all these, the cult of Werner Herzog is being created.
No, not the cult of Werner Herzog. I do not want to see any of clones of me.
Uh-huh.
No, it's a way of life. It's a way of creating your own cinema. It's demanding and not always rewarding. Face it. And there's no excuse today, because you can make a feature film today for $10,000. Just go out and work. And I tell them, don't work in an office. Go out and work as a bouncer in a sex club. Go there where there's pura vida, as the Mexicans would say. The
stuff of life. Yeah.
The rawness, the purity of life. That's where you have to be.
Werner Herzog, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Werner Herzog's new 3D documentary, his 28th film, is called Cave of Forgotten Dreams, and it comes out this weekend.
It's not my 28th film. Okay. Maybe you should say it again. It's at least my 60th.
Werner Herzog's new 3D documentary, his 60th film, perhaps, is called Cave of Forgotten Dreams, and it comes out this weekend.
I'm sorry, I never counted my films, but it must be over 60 by now.